Welcome to The Loins of History, a podcast dedicated to connecting the past to the present and correcting historical and political illiteracy. I'm Colin, and I'm joined by my co-host, Jay. Today, we're going to continue to talk about the Han Dynasty and its collapse. In our third episode, Jay is going to take us through the final days of the empire or the dynasty before it collapses. So, Jay, do you want to give us an overview of what you're going to be talking about today?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Colin. Yeah, like you said, this is our third and final episode on the fall of the Han Dynasty, episode 6 in our season on fall of empires or fall of civilizations. This episode, we're going to talk about two main categories, two groups of people, well, really a person and then a group of people that really significantly contributed to the fall of the Han Dynasty in the year 220 AD. The first person that we're going to talk about is the emperor himself. He was a guy named Liu Hong, who was known as Emperor Ling. And Emperor Ling was technically not the last emperor, but the emperors that succeeded him were all children. There were two child emperors that came after him, and they didn't like really have a significant, you know, they were pawns in the hands of the second group of people that we'll discuss. And that is the corrupt eunuchs and the role that these eunuchs played in court intrigue with the various consorts and warlords in the area. So with that, talking first about the weak leader Liu Hong and how he and his practices contributed to the fall of the Han Dynasty. So just as an overview to kind of cage our brains to what time frame we're talking about. Liu Hong came to power in February of the year 186 AD when he was just 12 years old. It was very common that emperors would have children replace them, at least initially, because like we mentioned in our last episode, the two main factions were all of the various consorts, i.e. the women who would be recruited from all over China to come in and basically be one of the emperor's wives, of which most of them would all bear children. And it was, you know, part of their own success if they could bear him male children. That would be one faction. The other faction would be the eunuchs, and we'll get more into them here in a second. Liu Hong, when he became Emperor Ling in 168, he was one of those children, and he would end up ruling until May of 189, and he would die from illness. So he didn't live that long, but his rule in charge of the Han Empire was kind of marked by this lackadaisical, I don't care attitude. I mentioned in the last episode that he was too busy doing role play with his consorts. And the second thing his rule was characterized by was that of corruption. So early in his reign, when he was 12 years old, and this all kind of first got started, he himself was the pawn of these two factions kind of vying for power within the imperial court. There was an empress dowager, which the empress dowager just means, hey, this person is granted like this female consort who is either the wife or the mother of the emperor is granted like you can be the empress or you can be the empress dowager. They're granted like this special authority to kind of rule either on behalf of or in place of the emperor himself. In our series on the U.S. and Chinese relations, one of the key figures in, you know, fast forward over 1700 years was Empress Dowager Xia Xi. I can never say her name right. I believe it's spelled C-E-X-I-E.
It's not C-C, is it?
No, it's not pronounced C-C, but it's like she or something like that. But anyway, again, horrible with these Mandarin pronunciations. But she actually ruled for like several decades in Qing Dynasty. She herself was an empress dowager. Anyway, kind of going back here to Emperor Ling, he was installed by his mother, the Empress Dowager Dou, and her father, Dou Wu. So he was the product of the consort faction against the eunuchs. Well, Empress Dowager Dou, her dad, Dou Wu, he, in trying to consolidate the power once Liu Hong was made emperor, he tried to have all of the eunuchs assassinated to try to crush the opposing faction. However, in what seems to be a recurring theme that is not good for empire stability, the eunuchs found out about his plot and then assassinated his entire family, to include himself. They kidnapped Emperor Ling when he was just a teenager, and every Dou, was murdered, except for the Empress Dowager herself, because, again, she held this kind of authoritative position. She was kind of hands-off at that point, and she was placed under house arrest until she died. So even though Emperor Ling was originally installed by the consort faction, he eventually came under the control of the eunuch faction. This is important because what we'll see here is that the eunuchs kind of gain in power, and this is actually one of the causes of the Yellow Turban Rebellion. Go ahead, Colin.
I was going to say, so the Empress Dowager, she was under house arrest. Did they do this because they needed to keep her alive but controlled? So it was almost kind of a symbol that they were going to rule through like this puppet, and it was really just maintaining the facade?
Yeah. There's like a, we remember here the mandate of heaven. The emperor is kind of seen not quite as like the Japanese emperor, like a god in actuality, but rather they are like the person picked by God to be the ruler, right? They have the mandate. The Han have the mandate of heaven. The Empress Dowager, even though herself, not by blood, she was a Dou. She was not a Liu, which, the Han emperors were all, their family name was Liu, L-I-U. Even though by blood she was not related, she was elevated to be the Empress Dowager, and that kind of gave her this like special status that the eunuchs couldn't really touch her, so to speak.
Because then they would be going to war with the gods, basically, right? Because they would be going against their handpicked, their chosen.
Right. And, the popular opinion is huge still. Mm-hmm. What was going on in the court was very much seen by the masses. And, if you assassinate the Empress Dowager, that was not going to be a good look for your faction either. So they kept her alive. and that kind of thing.
Interesting.
So the eunuch faction grows and grows in power, and Emperor Ling is all too happy to have the eunuchs run the show. Because like I've mentioned before, Emperor Ling was, as he became a young man and an adult, he kind of didn't care. All he cared about was living this life of luxury and opulence there in Luoyang, which was the Eastern Han's capital. Well, everyone else vying for power in China thought that this was a terrible idea. We talked about the Yellow Turban Rebellion, this Taoist sect in our last episode that you know, started this massive uprising where, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people ended up being killed, millions of people being displaced, millions of people like not working the farms. It was, even though the main part of the rebellion was kind of over within a year, there would be significant uprisings in the name of the Yellow Turbans, for, you know, 20 years after that fact. The emperor didn't seem to think too much that his own conduct and people kind of seeing him as an unworthy ruler, as, you know, an indicator that they might be losing the mandate of heaven, and that's why there's all this stuff. One last thing that the emperor would do that really pissed people off was he began selling political offices for money. And that started in the year 178. So, you know, he's a young man, he's 22 years old, he's been in power for 10 years. And he just decides, hey, we're going to start selling these titles, to the highest bidder. And, you know, if you've been paying attention as a part of this series, this will not be the first time that you will have heard, I can gain a political office. I can gain power and authority by just having some money. And the corrupting effect that that has on your government cannot be understated.
Yeah, if you remember from the Rome miniseries, that was one of the key causes. It caused not only economic strain because you had people on the payroll, but, you know, it caused a lot of instability because then you had people vying for offices and trying to buy each other out or raise armies to go push somebody out. So, you know, it's also interesting when you're talking about Emperor Liu in kind of his situation where he didn't care. Like, I kind of think of, you know, remember from our history of the Chinese and American relations, we had Emperor Puyi, who is the last emperor of the Qing. We didn't really get into Puyi's kind of later upbringing, but it was very similar. Like, he lived in the Forbidden City, and he had no real power after he was an infant. You know, the Qing dynasty went away and the Republic of China was founded, but he still lived in the Forbidden City in this very like kept lifestyle. And he was very cruel and very, like, he just didn't care about anybody else outside of himself. So you kind of have to take a look at this model of how emperors were picked. And it seems like it's kind of a recurring theme in China. So like a new dynasty comes in and everything seems okay for a while. There's stability, but then you start selecting child emperors, and children are raised to the throne and they kind of live in this very sheltered environment and they become very, very disconnected from the people and whom they rule. And it gets very bad. Like, Puyi was an awful, awful person for most of his life. Kind of an interesting turnaround at the end. Maybe we'll talk about that later, but, I don't know. It just sounded kind of interesting. Like, they paralleled each other almost, like almost essentially the last emperors of their dynasties.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it kind of goes back to one of the main ideas here, and that is like weak leadership. Things kind of divulge into self-interested factions, right? Like, both factions, the consorts and the eunuchs, one of the things that they would do is they were all about like securing their individual or family estates there in Luoyang. So they would like build mansions. They would use state money to build mansions for themselves. And it's just like, you know, when I'm reading about all this stuff, I can't help but think like, how self-serving that whole thing is in the chaos. And now, granted, you know, history is, you know, hindsight's 20/20 vision. And, you know, Yellow Turban Rebellion, I think, was in 84 and 85, 184 and 185. You know, the Three Kingdoms period wouldn't really kick off until 89-90. So, you know, 4 to 5 years, after that, you know, we know that China basically divulged into chaos after that fact where millions of people would die over the span of like 60 to 80 years. Actually, maybe almost 100 years. It was pretty late in the 200s when the Three Kingdoms period was finally ended and consolidated by the Sima family. But, you know, we look at that and go, how could they not have known that their corrupt practices were just going to bring such chaos? And the reality is like when you're not thinking about anybody but yourself, of course you're not thinking about the consequences of your actions. You're thinking about how do I get more money to build my pleasure palace in downtown Luoyang.
So question for you. Within Rome, like when we talked about Rome, there was this big discussion we had about like the loss of virtue and comparing kind of the early, not even really the early Republic, but just the Republic in general in this virtuous Roman, like even the plebes and the patricians alike kind of had the same values. And then you see toward late antiquity, especially like at some point they just lost it all. And we made the case it was this gradual process, but like rulers and plebes alike had no virtue whatsoever. Is that similar to the Han Chinese in the Han Dynasty? Because like you look at, you know, like, is this weak, self-interested emperor in this court intrigue kind of an anomaly that only existed within the bubble of the palace and the court? Or is it something that is just a byproduct of something larger and it just manifested in the court?
Yeah, I think Chinese society looked to the emperor for it's like guiding compass. You know, if we remember here, Confucianism isn't a religion. Right? Confucius was writing what he believed to be the principles of the heyday of China back in the summer and autumn period, or the spring and autumn period. I have to fact check me on that one. But you know, it's not a religion. So there's not like these, there's not like a separate ethical, moral component to China. They really look to their leaders. Like they really look to like, you know, their understanding of heaven as given to them by the emperor, by the court, like by, you know, it's, you know, Confucianism is extremely authoritarian in that it's like, you have your betters and you need to like do what they say. So when you see, you know, your Chinese peasant, Zhang, and you see the corruption, the depravity, the, you know, the terrible behavior that's going on, the lack of virtue in what's really just common sense, to every human being. And then you look at your own lot in life and you're like laboring under heavy taxes, corvée labor, you know, your daughter just got yanked up to be a consort to the emperor, right? Just so he can like sleep around with more people. You're not happy. And then when the Yellow River floods or like half your family dies from some pandemic, like you're probably pretty angry. And you know, your society is ripe for, you know, division, conflict, bloodshed, etc.
So it would have been more of a top-down type of corruption and change. I shouldn't say corruption because yes. It's like a top-down effect, really. So it was being felt, okay, at the center in the court, it starts, and the byproducts of that corruption within the court is felt then throughout the countryside. And then the countryside then turns and looks at that and says, hey, we have a problem at the top.
Yeah, like for example, you know, Rome would do bread and games, right? There's the Colosseum. Like, let's just get the plebes in the Colosseum. Like,
it
throw
sounds
some
so
bread at them.
When you say the plebes,
the peasants.
I mean, it kind of was, but yeah, get the peasants in there.
Well, from their perspective, right? I'm sure that's what I mean. Like, from their from the ruling elite's perspective, like, let's just medicate the masses. And that in and of itself brings like a loss of virtue, right? Mm-hmm. I think we're seeing this today. As you know, TikTok was all in the news today, and TikTok has been attacked over and over again for you know, becoming like a brain drain on society. It's our version of bread and games. It doesn't help us become a more virtuous society. That was very prevalent. That reality was very prevalent in the Roman world. However, in the Chinese world, I actually don't think we see that much of it in the lower classes. I think what we see in the lower class is almost like a, you know, the captivity of the Hebrews under the Egyptians. It's like, you know, the Hebrews are just suffering and struggling and they need freedom, right? And mm-hmm. they're looking for a leader to bring them into the promised land. It's more of that kind of thing. Like there's no comment saying that, you know, the nation of Israel, when it was in its, you know, 400 years of captivity in Egypt, that it like deserved it, unlike the Babylonian captivity, which it did deserve that later, right? There's nothing commenting here about the toils and struggles that the Han Chinese peasant is due to their own lack of moral virtue. Rather, it's very much seen in this like righteous, you know, we're the good guys here. Mm. The Han have lost the mandate of heaven. Therefore, it's up to one of us. And these warlords would definitely play on the theme, you know, later in the Three Kingdoms period on like being a person of the people. You know, Cao Cao was brilliant at, you know, when he would lead his troops, I think there's one story of him like making this edict. He's trying to do like a forced march. And he's like, if anybody, if anybody like falls off the road, he'll be executed. Well, then like something scares Cao Cao's horse. And then his horse like takes him off the road. And somebody's like, oh no, general, like you broke your own rule. And Cao Cao like stands up and goes like, you're right. I broke my own rule. Therefore, you men, execute me right now. And the guy's like, oh, what? No, I can't do that. Like,
he was serious all along.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, no. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, Cao Cao being brilliant and evil. He's an evil genius for sure. And, you know, all of his troops are like, because he's the source of their food. He's the source of their pay. He's their source of inspiration, like in this Confucian society. And he's like, execute me. And they're like, no, we will never do that, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, we beg you, don't do that. And he goes, fine. Instead, you can cut my hair off my head and have my hair, this, not a top knot in the Qing style, but like, you know, they would have long hair and then fold it on top of their head. Excuse me. He's like, cut my hair off, put it on a stake and parade it around in front of everybody. And it's like, you know, people, when they see Cao Cao holding himself to his own rules, they see like that's a strong leader. Like that's somebody who's not above the common soldier. Whereas you have someone like, you know, Emperor Ling, who, like you said, knows nothing of the common man, has probably barely traveled outside of Luoyang, knows nothing of what's going on, and all he does is, you know, sleep with random hot women pulled in from all over China and play games with them, and then take more money from the peasants.
It kind of reminds me, I don't know where I read this, but a tyrant always feels more comfortable with his enemies than he does his own people. So, like, and what I mean by that is someone like Cao Cao could get up and so he could get up in front of his own soldiers and make a speech like that. He knew his men enough. Julius Caesar was the same way. He could walk with his soldiers and rally them, because he felt a comfort and a bond and a kinship with them. There's a story of Julius Caesar, like after he had crossed the Rubicon and taken Rome, his men were like, all right, we're done. Like, this is enough. We marched with you through Gaul. We invaded Britain. We're now here. We've marched on our own people. Like, we're done. he basically comes out and he says, all right, fine. None of you want to, he's like, go take your reward. He's like, you're not going to share with a greater reward when I go take it. And he basically shamed him. And they're like, okay, Julius, don't let us out. We know you're going for greater glory. We want to follow you. Whereas somebody like Emperor Liu or other tyrants would feel more comfortable with the scheming eunuchs, with people who do not have the best interest of the people. They don't possess the noblesse oblige. They don't have the best interest of the people in mind. They're all so self-interested. It's kind of like you feel more comfortable in a pit of snakes, in the enemies of your people versus the common man. You know, there's stories of leaders, and say what you want about them, and nobody's perfect, but throughout history, who were able to inspire the common man or woman through history, they were able to walk with their people, make a speech like that, do great things, and whether some of it's apocryphal and kind of inflated, maybe, but they could do that. Tyrants never could. They relied on force, schemes, money to do so, and it's a sign of a declining empire when you start to have more tyrants and people like that in positions of power. And that's where that disconnect grows, kind of like you're talking about here with the Han, where the average Chinese peasant is like, it's up to me to do something because they've lost the mandate of heaven because they no longer care about me. Look at all this bad stuff that's happening. So as the disconnect grows wider and wider, that's, like you mentioned, ripe for ripe for civil unrest. And it's interesting with the Han Chinese that you kind of mention, it's like, the emperor has the mandate of heaven. So he's the chosen. He's been chosen, divinely chosen. Yeah. And when you lose that, it's the citizen's responsibility or somebody in the Chinese domain, the Chinese empire, whatever dynasty. And I say Chinese empire because I'm speaking dynasty wide, to do something about it. Thus all these rebellions. Rome was a little different, but I feel like the U.S. kind of leans almost and shares that sort of with the Han. I think we almost kind of lean that way a little bit more.
Yeah, as it's funny, as you were talking, I actually thought of multiple examples here in the U.S. of, you know, it's kind of funny. So, you know, our listeners, I think if you've listened to us since our first series on Russia-Ukraine, I think you'll know that while sometimes Colin and I take like strong political positions, I think we go above and beyond to try to be fair to both sides, right? And with that being said, the Democrat Party, going back to our history of the political parties and how we got Republicans and Democrats, which is like two of the most fun and entertaining episodes that I think we've done on this podcast. But you know, the Democratic Party has been around since basically Thomas Jefferson, and they've always been the party of the people. In this Han Chinese situation, it's like they were the, they were not the ones in the court intrigue. They were the ones that represented like the rural farmers, the merchant classes that were just out there, normal day-to-day Americans kind of doing their thing. And then, you know, something after World War II, during the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, the Democratic Party became the party of the elite and those who are on welfare. The party of people who, instead of being contrary to the federal government, kind of representing the common man against the state, the Democratic Party became those who used the federal government to advance their schemes, as well as of the people who desperately need the government to survive. And what that's done is, I think that kind of characterization explains a lot of the angst. I have quite a few friends that politically speaking are on the left. They're either Democrats or they're not Democrats. but they're on the political left. And one common thing I see in conversations with these friends is they don't understand. They view the right as like simpletons. They view those on the right as Nazis or like, you know, uneducated and
low status. You know,
low status, right. And the irony here is like when, you know, somebody doesn't even have to be a card-carrying member of the Republican Party, right? But just like a middle class, middle income, average Joe from somewhere in middle America, right? I think this is why Ohio and Pennsylvania, by the way, have swung to the right, is just like these regular middle class people. And they see something about Hunter Biden. And they see, you know, the images of Hunter Biden like literally doing strip, you know, hookers and blow on video. And then you hear about Hunter Biden like doing some super corrupt deals with the Ukrainians or with the Chinese. And you see this and you're like, these people don't represent me. These people don't speak for how I view the world. In the same way that the Chinese peasant, when they would look at the emperor, they'd go like, this is not okay. This person is not, like, they're no longer worthy to be my ruler. And then all of a sudden, someone as freaking wild as Donald Trump shows up. And in a way that, frankly, still kind of confuses me, these same people relate to the billionaire from New York. But they relate to him because Donald Trump spoke up and he speaks up on their behalf. And these people are like, oh, there's no way he's going to win an election. Like, there's no way he can beat Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton's been a senator. Donald Trump's, you know, been bankrupt like three times, like blah, 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 blah. And then lo and behold, he wins, right?
Go ahead. Keep going. No, you keep going. You're on a roll. Keep going. Sorry.
No. Like, it's just this idea that when you no longer believe that you're, you know, we live in a representative democracy, you know, a democratic republic, you know, in China, Han China definitely wasn't that. But at the same time, like, even though we are a democracy, we still submit to our government in some kind of authoritative position over us, just like the Chinese peasant, right? But when you see those people that you've either willingly or unwillingly submitted yourself to as an authority in your life, and you see them living so corruptly in this state of debauchery, if you're Hunter Biden, right? Like, and I saw a news article today, like, we're looking at new charges coming out against him. Or to be fair, like, you know, the news stuff came out today about George Santos, and the dude's literally spending campaign funds on OnlyFans, right? And he's a Republican. So it's like, we have, I think a lot of people are just sick and tired of the corruption in the most general sense of the word corruption, right? Which, oh, by the way, Americans who are listening, your campaign funds being used for things that are not campaigning is a time-honored practice. And if this
is
something,
go back and listen to our podcast about that. We have a podcast about dark money.
Oh, and yeah, that's right. You did give us a good one on dark money. Yeah.
There's a thing called dark money that you think PACs and super PACs are powerful, but where does all the foreign money come in? That's completely untraced. Jay, yeah. I'm going to try and relate this kind of more back to the Han. I kind of take what you said and go back.
Sorry, I was on a tangent.
No. It's really good because it's important. So looking at, like, you mentioned Donald Trump. How do you relate to this billionaire? Well, Donald Trump never claimed not to be a billionaire. He never claimed not to be a playboy. That was his image. Mm-hmm. That was him. And people kind of resonated with the authenticity of it. The GOP in particular has had a terrible time because they will campaign on somebody who has quote unquote family values and will have the, you know, the veneer of a happy family, the all-American family, two kids, got a lab, and they will do everything they can to craft that image. But it's like the uncanny valley effect. Like you look at it and you think something's just not right there.
It's not authentic.
It's not authentic. And then it turns out like it's completely not. And, you know, there's all these issues. It's funny, like Mitt Romney is a wildly successful businessman. He's very smart. But like the guy gets up there and he blunders. Remember the binder full of women comment? And he didn't know how to, he didn't know how to, like recoup from that. He didn't know how to spin it and laugh. He couldn't walk into a Dairy Queen and make a joke about a blizzard and have the whole thing. He couldn't do that.
Did you come up with that, Colin?
No, no, no. Donald Trump did. And I saw the clip.
Oh, Donald Trump said that?
He walks into a Dairy Queen and he's like, what the heck do you call this thing? I think they call it a blizzard. Everyone laughs. They thought it was hilarious because he was truly being authentic. And it kind of goes back. That's kind of my point is like, somebody like a Mitt Romney, who on paper has this crafted veneer of Mr. Winsome. Yeah. And then you have this playboy sleazebag businessman over here who somehow is resonating with people. And he can walk into a factory. He could walk into Harlem. He could walk in anywhere he wanted and befriend people. So it kind of goes back to my point of somebody who can walk amongst his own people and feel comfortable versus somebody who feels very uncomfortable. And kind of going to keep taking this back to the Han, it's very similar. Like it sounds to me like what we've been talking about is as the Han dynasty progressed, you start having this preservation of the facade of this fake kind of, or it's kind of vestigial. It's like this vestigial apparatus that just kind of exists in name only without any of the actual substance that propped it up in the first place. Like, hey, we're going to put the Empress Dowager under house arrest. We're not going to kill her. We're just going to take away everything that she has because she's a figurehead. Okay. But then you're going to go in and manipulate everything else around it. But you're just going to, the trouble that they went through to prop up a powerless empress, and they took all this power from her because of the image. It's kind of the same thing. It's like the eunuchs propped up this image. Emperor Liu just was like, hey, I'm in charge, but I don't really care. I'm just going to sleep with a bunch of women and kind of party and live here. I don't really care what's going on. I've got the title. So they lose this connection of authenticity. People can see through it. And that's why throughout some of these rebellions, like Cao Cao, even if you're unsuccessful at times, like you can, Mao was a school teacher somehow, noble birth, but he was able to lead the CCP.
Yeah.
Because he found a message that resonated that was authentic.
Right. I wasn't even thinking about authenticity, doing research, but I think inauthenticity is a sign of weakness. Like if you cannot be comfortable enough in your own skin that you feel like you have to put on this facade so that, especially in American politics, literally so that other people will like you enough to vote for you or to donate their money to you. Right. It's like, to me, that's a sign of weakness. And you're right. Like, I think this is why Donald Trump inspires loyalty, frankly.
Fanaticism.
With so many people is because he projects this image of strength that, I think, I'm not going to say that it's 100% authentic because there was a great video of like Donald's like the 21 things that Donald Trump's the best at. And it's just him saying that like, I'm the best at, no one supports the military more than me. No one's stronger than me. No, like, okay, Don, like you're full of it, man. Like,
he's a showman.
Right. Like there is that aspect, but when the 4 years he was in office, like his whole policy, like just on foreign policy was like, we're going to get tough with Mexico about drugs and the border. We're going to get tough with China over trade. We're going to get tough with North Korea about their nuclear missile program. We're going to get tough with Europe over, you know, trade imbalances, etc. Like, he actually put his policy mouth where, wait, put his money where his mouth was. There we go.
Very good.
Yeah. You're right. Like, and he actually did. Like, whereas right now, I think, like, no one believes that Joe Biden's doing that. Nobody believes that, you know, the summit with Xi Jinping in San Francisco, I think, that wrapped up today. Literally no one believes that Joe Biden, you know, talked tough to Xi Jinping, because Xi Jinping is a strong leader. Like, I mean, I'm definitely no fan of the CCP and Xi Jinping, but at the same time, like, I'm under no illusions whatsoever that Joe Biden was, like, you know, talking tough to him.
Yeah. I mean, think about the stories you mentioned about Cao Cao. An inauthentic.
Thank you for bringing it back to China.
I'm trying. Well, I mean, we're talking about China, but we're kind of saying modern China. But think about it. Like, he, in a moment, had to decide, and I'm making it a little more dramatic, I guess, you're thinking through this. But yeah, I have to think that if that story is true, he probably had a moment where he got off the road and somebody might have said something, or he realized that he broke his rule. What am I going to do? And it's like, well, I could decide to say, I don't care. I'm your ruler. Get back in line and get on my horse and go. Or I can create this other spectacle, whether inauthentic or, you know, whether truly, like, I'm going to actually let you kill me or not. I've got to figure out a way to spin this and at least make an attempt to try and connect with these people. And he did.
Yeah.
Whether, you know, can you imagine Emperor Liu doing that? No, he wouldn't even be out there with his troops.
Yes.
And I would say the same thing happened in Rome. I mean, the last 20 years, you mentioned kind of with the Han, the last few emperors were all children and, you know, they were just easily replaced, assassinated, died, you know, whatever. They just cycled them through for the past couple of years. Rome was the same way. It was just shadow. They called it the shadow emperors. After Valentinian III, they're nobodies, self-interested nobodies that they just cycled through. Assassinate, move through, and it's just very similar how they acted together. But
yeah, the writing's on the wall when you see that happening.
Yeah, I mean, so that's the emperors. Can you talk more about the eunuchs, like the snakes that had got into, you know, the snakes that got into the courtroom, the pit of vipers?
Yeah, for sure. So, kind of moving on to the second part here, and we've definitely talked a lot about it already, but going into a little bit more detail about the eunuchs and their role in court intrigue. And this will kind of take us directly up until what's known as the Three Kingdoms period, or at least where the novel, The Romance of the Three Kingdoms, kind of starts off. But just to recap super briefly, I talked a lot about eunuchs and how they came to be in our last episode, but eunuchs had been a part of the civil service in China since the Qin Dynasty, which was the first major dynasty in China, and it was the dynasty immediately preceding the Han. There was this punishment system called the Five Punishments. Castration was one of the punishments. So it was actually somewhat common for men to have both the testicles and the penis removed. It is not one or the other. It was the entire system down there. And they would have everything removed. They would become a eunuch. And then it was very common, especially if they were learned men, that they would enter into the civil service. So commit a crime, you know, congrats, you now have to work for the state. And again, the logic was that, oh, these guys cannot have children, therefore they're not going to try to seize power and create a dynasty of their own, because there's no one to pass that off to. However, you know, these eunuchs, who were sometimes criminals, they were very much involved in power dynamics. They were very much involved in enriching their position. There's one story, I kind of referred to it, but there's one story during Emperor Ling's time that these two eunuchs had, like, built these two massive mansions. And then one time the there in Luoyang, and the emperor kind of wandered too far out from his little part of the imperial palace. And they were afraid that he was going to see the mansions that these eunuchs had built for themselves. And they were like, hey, don't go over there. He's like, why not? And he's like, it's not safe. We think you should not do that. Oh, that's what it was. It was in order to see these mansions, there was like this observation tower that he could climb. And they were like, don't climb the tower. It's not safe. You could trip, you could fall, you could fall off the tower at the top. Like, it's terrible. The gods have ordained that you do, you should not climb this observation tower, because if he did, he would see these mansions. So he's like, okay. And for the rest of his life, he did not climb a tower. Like, craziness, man. Like, the extent that these guys would go to hide their own self-interest and, like, you know, pulling the money and all this stuff. And to be fair, the various consorts and the empresses would do the exact same thing. The emperor himself would do the exact same thing. You know, building these gardens was a big deal at the time. And, you know, it was just fraud, waste, and abuse back, you know, Han Dynasty edition. Kind of get a little bit more specific here. In the late Han Dynasty, during Emperor Ling's time, there was a specific group of eunuchs called the Ten Attendants. These Ten Attendants would play a major role in the fall of the Han Dynasty. But just for the sake of time, these Ten Attendants were kind of seen as the eunuchs to rule all of the rest of the eunuchs. And they were seen as the main
eunuchs to rule them all.
Ten eunuchs to rule them all. Yes.
And in the darkness bind them.
And in the darkness bind them. Get that tattooed on your back. no balls. Oh, man. The eunuchs jokes.
We like to have fun here.
They tell themselves, right? Yeah, so these Ten Attendants, they were the main advisors to the emperor, and it was just this massive corrupt system. So they're just telling him to be more corrupt. And a lot of people on the outside, so not just the consorts who wanted their children to be the next emperor, but also the warlords on the outside, who some, like Cao Cao, were super ambitious. Others, like Yuan Shao, who had his own fair share of ambition that would definitely come to bloom in the future. But Yuan Shao was a military guy. He was a colonel during the Yellow Turban Rebellion, became a general later, you know, still very much in this like traditional conservative, you know, moralistic view of like, this isn't right, I need to do something about it type deal. Well, in our last episode, we kind of mentioned that some of the eunuchs were cooperating with the Yellow Turbans. One to two of the Ten Attendants were cooperating with the Yellow Turbans. Interestingly enough, the original guy who was executed was not a eunuch. He was just another court official, not a eunuch. He wrote what's called a memorial, which technically anybody in China could have written a memorial, this, you know, this poetic verse to the emperor. But it was common that not just anybody would write these things. And this one court official wrote this memorial, basically begging the emperor to execute all of the Ten Attendants because he thought they were, you know, corrupt, and that that move would appease the civilians because the Yellow Turban Rebellion was like imminent. Well, the emperor decides, I'm going to bring the Ten Attendants in here and I'm going to question them about it. And those guys, when the emperor said, is this what's going on? The attendants like bowed down, put their heads to the floor, like took their hats off and was like, sir, we are begging you to execute us. Brilliant move, because the emperor was like, oh, See, they're innocent. Nothing's going on. And so when he passed that judgment and was like, see, if they're innocent, or if they were guilty, they wouldn't be saying all this stuff. So they must be innocent. Well, the eunuchs were like, hey, that guy who just blamed us for all of our problems, he's the one who's converted to Taoism. He's the one that's been working with the El Turbans. So the emperor was like, throw him in jail. Believe it or not, jail. Threw him in jail, and he ended up dying in prison. Then later it was found out two of the 10 attendants were in fact cooperating with the El Turbans. The emperor did find out about it, and the emperor did execute both of those attendants. That was kind of their role in the Yellow Turban Rebellion. But even after the Yellow Turban Rebellion, these 10 attendants would still end up having significant pull over the emperor. Well, when the emperor died in 189 AD, so right here, right on the threshold of the Three Kingdoms period, right at the, like, the Han still, you know, existed, but Emperor Ling dies. And there's the standard power struggle that always occurred between the various consorts who would assassinate one another's sons. The eunuchs would, like, pick a favorite, blah, blah, blah. And there was this specific general. He was actually the general in chief, and his name was He Jin. He Jin was able to maneuver to have his candidate installed, who ended up being the like a 12-year-old son of another consort that he liked. So He Jin was successful, and he actually kind of outmaneuvered one of the 10 attendants who had gained a lot of power. He installed his candidate as the emperor, but then later the eunuchs conspired and had him assassinated. This is big because He Jin was the general-in-chief of the entire military. Well, a lot of the military guys, cough, cough, these regional warlords, they hatched this idea that they've had it. It's time for the eunuchs to go. So they end up sending this is Yuan Shao, end up writing a letter to like five different generals, one of which was Duong Zhuo, who we talked at length about in our last episode. They said, we want these guys to come to the palace here in Luoyang and to beg the emperor, who's like 12 at this time, the new emperor, to execute all the eunuchs. Well, when Yuan Shao and they like hatch this plan, but then they find out that the eunuchs are like onto him. So Yuan Shao and some of his boys, they go into they decide to take matters into their own hand, and then they massacre almost all of the eunuchs. Like some 2,000 people ended up dying. And there was, you know, there's one story that goes that these various generals, you know, attacked the city trying to kill all the eunuchs, that some of the Imperial Guard were so scared because they were young boys who had not grown facial hair yet. So that when Yuan Shao and his troops came into the capital, they basically like dropped their pants. We're not eunuchs. Like, show them their balls. Don't kill me. I'm not a eunuch.
History's wild, man.
History's wild, right? some 2,000 people ended up dying. Some of the eunuchs tried to capture the emperor, the empress dowager, and his younger brother, I won't get too far ahead here. So this like party, they try to run away from Luoyang. Well, on the road, they run into the guy who just got called to Luoyang, Duong Zhuo. And Duong Zhuo, the story goes, ended up liking the younger brother better than the current emperor. So he just killed off the 12-year-old boy and installed the 8-year-old. I don't know how to pronounce his name. Liu Shi. Yuxie, XIE, and ended up making him the last emperor of the Han Dynasty. And Liu Xie would be in power until 220 AD. He, Duong Zhuo, you know, became the tyrant Duong Zhuo, as the Romance of the Three Kingdoms story goes. Yuan Shao would try to evict him, but Duong Zhuo ended up running away, burned Luo Yang to the ground, fleeing to Chang'an, and, you know, establishing, which was the old capital of the Western Han Dynasty, hanging out there. Duong Zhuo would be assassinated by one of his bodyguards or adopted son, as the story goes, Lu Bu, and, you know, chaos. The Liu Xie would end up fleeing from Duong Zhuo, and on the road would be picked up by, again, by none other than Cao Cao. And he would be under Cao Cao's protection in Cao Cao's capital until Cao Cao's son, Cao Pi, demanded that Liu Xie abdicate in 220. And that is how the Han Dynasty fell, and we enter into the Three Kingdoms period. One of the takeaways, I think, in kind of big picture, looking at the fall of the Han Dynasty and what it means, right? Like, we are a podcast that desires to connect history to current events, right? Mm. Like, we believe that history can inform stuff, inform our decision-making and, you know, beliefs today. And, you know, kind of thinking about how did the Han fall, right? Like, there was, you know, there's all these natural disasters. There's this loss of the Mandate of Heaven. There's the rebellion. There's corruption. And I think there's actually a lot that can be spoken to what's going on here in the United States. Excuse me. And I think it's helpful to think about what's similar, but also what's different, right? Hmm. I mean, the first thing that just on a positive note, I think, and I kind of mentioned this before, an inherently democratic system is always more resilient than an authoritarian system. In all of Imperial China, you know, the quote that we had at the beginning of this little series, you know, the empire long divided must unite, long united must divide, thus it has always been. You know, when you have these dynastic struggles, this authoritarian system that is purely based on an emperor, when you remove that family, this dynasty, from the system, like, the system collapses and it's inherently unstable in that regard. Whereas I think, you know, post-Enlightenment democratic systems have this inherent stability that comes with them, because it's like a direct will of the people in picking and choosing who their leaders are. And instead of the people having to rise up in rebellion, like the Yellow Turbans, you know, there's mechanisms where the leaders actually submit to the people. This is a positive note. Like, it's not all doom and gloom here on the lines of history, right? Like, this is, I think it's just, it goes to show that we do have beneficial structures. You know, to give more modern more modern things, you know, in the Soviet Union, not a democratic system, every single time somebody changed power in the Soviet Union, like, there would be years that would go by and we weren't entirely sure who was running the show.
We talk about that in other episodes, by the way. Go back and listen.
That's right. That's right. China, another one. You know, there were, you know, when Mao died, you know, there was an intense power struggle. Now, in those specific instances, both the Soviet Union and the CCP, it did not result in the collapse of their society per se. Definitely not in the CCP. and the Soviet Union ended up collapsing for other reasons. But there's this inherent chaos and stability, whereas we here in the United States have, you know, with one questionable exception, have always had a peaceful transfer of power, which, and I say it's questionable, it was a peaceful transfer of power. There was one little hiccup, but, you know, I think the point is I think it goes to show that we should not lose trust and confidence in our democratic system. It actually could be a lot worse than this. And I think the way the Han Dynasty would change power is an example of that.
I would agree with that. And not to be negative or a downer after you're positive, I would simply state that, and no, this is really more of something that I'm, as we talk through these empires and their collapse, we're seeing similarities between Rome and the Han and even potentially the US and some of these other, you know, the Byzantines, the British. I almost kind of want to go back to the Bronze Age and talk about that. And some of these other empires that we're going to talk about, I think that even in a democratic society, I still think there has to be an element of virtue, and we got to define that maybe in one of these future episodes, but that both citizen and ruler have to abide by. They have to share in that virtue and that common idea of greater good, obligation to, you know, that duty, civic and moral duty.
Yeah.
And like in Rome, you see it throughout the empire, they lose it. They're no longer resilient enough to withstand the onslaught that they faced. And then the Han, you know, as we talked about, it was really more of the rulers who, you know, lost this virtue and thus the mandate. And this is in a launched them into a period of instability. And in the US, I think that's something that we're going to explore. And I'll expand on that and what I'm my thoughts and feelings on it when I get it fully fleshed out. But I think that is one of the chief causes of instability in the US. Like everything else that we see is really just a symptom, you know, that is downstream. And yeah, because I think it catapults you into a vicious cycle where all these other things start to go wrong and institutions and systems that you have in place to prop up and maintain stability and maintain an empire, a dynasty, a nation erode away. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, no, I agree with that 100%. I think one of the key aspects of losing the mandate of heaven is this unworthiness aspect to it, which, you know, in the Roman context may be called like a loss of virtue, but it's this like the moral component erodes your legitimacy in the eyes of the people, right? Mm. Like the people want good rulers, right? Like the people want virtuous rulers. Like the people don't want corruption. And, you know, one of the scarier things here in the United States is that we are on a slippery slope. You know, I think we may have talked about it in one of our first episodes in the season, is like when you begin this inertia towards collapse, it is really hard to come back from that.
Civilizational inertia, yeah.
Right. And, you know, and you kind of, it's slow, it's subtle.
You don't see it.
You don't realize it until it's too late, right? And it's kind of like, I think one of the takeaways I think that we'll see over and over again, because it's already come up twice, so we're two for two now.
It's going to come up in the next one.
And it's going to come up again, is when there's like this moral decay and this corruption and a loss of confidence that, you know, your government is doing the right thing. Like the good luck coming back from that, you know? Yeah, off the top of my head, I can't think of a single historical example of where you had a corrupt system that was able to fix itself. You usually had to bring the whole sucker down, which, you know, to do my, you know, haven't done a Thucydides pitch in quite some time. Everyone should read Thucydides. It's one of the best history books, History of the Peloponnesian War. And he's got like a whole chapter on the revolution that took place in Athens during the war. In the way Thucydides talks about the revolution where, you know, Athens briefly became an oligarchy is terrible. It's like he describes revolution as a cancer. And I think that's good for us to hear. Like when we, you know, there are certain people, you know, the yellow turbans of us that are calling for the overthrow of the system. And it's like, dude, like you don't know what
you're
asking
for. Do you understand? Like I understand where you're at, but it's like a tube of toothpaste. Once you squeeze it and that toothpaste out, it can't go back in. It's ugly. And that's a good way to put it.
It's impossible to control. Like you, as a matter of fact, I can think of a historical example of this. The American Revolution is a great case in point. But I'm going to be super brief. I wish I could elaborate further on this because this is an excellent thing that's worth talking about. The American Revolution was able to be controlled. The original people that signed the Declaration of Independence, a large part of them were still around at the end of the war, helped frame the Constitution itself and presented like the stable republic. Why was that the case? Because in the French Revolution, that was not the case. The original Jacobins ended up being guillotined themselves. And all of a sudden, you get Napoleon and like it got out of their hands, blah, 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 blah. Why is that different? The reason why that was different was this concept of the lesser magistrate. The American Revolution was actually just from an ethical standpoint because you had the state legislatures who formed a Continental Congress. And under that lesser body of authority, underneath the English Parliament and the Crown, the British Crown, the Declaration of Independence is about dissolving the bonds, right? Because the greater magistrate has proved themselves to be unworthy, right? And because those bonds were dissolved, we already had a substructure, this doctrine of the lesser magistrate, right? Like we had this substructure that could then take over. There wasn't much of a power struggle. We already had state legislatures. You know, they were colonial legislatures. But what we now know is state legislatures, they were able to take over. They guided us through. It wasn't this like, you know, vive la revolution type deal.
It wasn't a feeling that people just latched onto. Great point. Right. We need to talk about that when we talk about the collapse of the British Empire again.
The 1947, 49.
Oh, but we can make a brief pit stop in 1776.
America.
Jay, I think with that, we should probably wrap up. Thank you all for listening to us for another mini series on our Fall of Empires expanded series where we've talked about the Han, we've talked about the Roman Empire. Next week we're going to talk about the Byzantine Empire, or as I like to call it, the Byzantine Dynasty of the Roman Empire. I'll touch on that a little bit during the next episode, but thank you for listening to us.
I've never heard that before, Colin.
It's a controversial take in the history community, but I plan to defend it. Anyway, thank you all for listening to us. Please like, subscribe. We're now on YouTube as well. So if you want to subscribe to us on YouTube, you can. Otherwise, check out us on Spotify, Podcast App, Podcast Addict, Apple. Leave us a comment and a like if you leave us a 5-star and a comment so we can call you out by name. I noticed we have a few more ratings, but no comments. If you have a comment, something constructive, please. We'll give you a shout out in the next episode, maybe at the beginning so you can actually hear your shout out. You don't have to wait till an hour and 10 minutes in to hear that shout out. We'll give it to you up front. We do appreciate feedback. We are on social media as well, on Instagram, Twitter. You can reach us via Gmail as well. We do have had a few emails from some fans that asked a few questions. We do enjoy interacting with you. And with that being said, hope you enjoyed the episode. Look forward to talking with you next week. Thank you.